Greetings, salivating masses, and welcome to the official Smug Engine Kickstarter.
We are truly humbled by your generosity and excitement. Truly, as the unapproachably genius designers of the most revolutionary game engine since H.G. Wells drunkenly scribbled out Little Wars, we are humbled.
I don't think it's even possible for us to be more excited to bring you this incredible opportunity through the medium of Kickstarter, one of the world's leading platforms for innovative business models such as crowdfunding. Through crowdfunding, we're able to begin taking your money now, months, years, or perhaps even decades before any product becomes available.
And what could be more trustworthy than a game designed, created by true pioneers like us? Our business model is sleek, new, and prototypical. We won't be slowed down in our work by experience or employees like those seasoned veterans endlessly churning out predictable garbage.
Those guys are the worst. With us, you're getting first-time Kickstarter designers, ensuring a historic failure rate at an unprecedented 0%. You can't lose. Let's lay out our business plan now.
Upon achieving our stated goal of only $250,000, we'll immediately launch into action, scheduling interviews, hosting awesome parties funded, but not attended by, our highest level donors, and taking fact-finding sabbaticals to valuable historical sites, such as Las Vegas and Atlantic City. At a certain point during this process, we'll also design, write, layout, publish, and mail out the game.
We sure probably will. And don't you worry about contact and updates during this exciting process. We'll send out a monthly update on our progress. Since we both only work on computers that we buy from the Craigslist personal section and have parents prone to lots of scary but non-threatening illnesses, you can look forward to years of updates on our dismal-sounding personal lives, holding us back from releasing your bought and paid for masterpieces.
Not to mention our endless fights with greedy artists and shiftless editors.
Now you already know the goals. Let's take a moment to discuss your awesome reward tiers.
At a donation level of only $5, we'll thank you in a way you'll never recognize or appreciate.
At $25, you'll receive a copy of the cover of the game, including both the front and back covers, in full glorious photocopied black and white.
$50 will net you the PDF of the Smug Engine, though at this range we unfortunately cannot offer international shipping.
At $75, subscribers will earn two copies of the Smug Engine PDF. That second PDF is an incredible value at 50% off the price. Keep one and send another to a friend.
Now we hit the exciting tiers. For $100, you'll receive a printed copy of the game, which we will have available for pickup at the first Gen Con after the game is complete. Merely arrive at Gen Con, find our booth, wait in line alongside day of buyers, provide your original receipt ticket and personalized 36-digit passphrase, and the Smug Engine is yours, assuming we didn't sell them all to day of buyers.
Or people buying by the gross from us during preview night.
Right, they also get access first.
For $250, we'll mail you a book from probably the second printing, featuring our printed signatures and an enclosed photo of John yelling on the toilet.
For $750, your name will be included in the book in our exhaustive list of lepers, degenerates, and addle-pated beefwits found throughout the Smug Engine universe.
At our VIP tier of $1,500, you will be helping us fund our exciting kickoff party, and spaces are limited. Of course, this means you can't go. We need that room for industry insiders and mega babes, but we'll text you from it. It might even be a picture text.
And finally, our ultimate tier of $1 million. This tier has only 5 openings, so act fast. People joining our Kickstarter at this tier receive all the previous benefits, a copy of the book, signed by what you'll have to assume is us, and one night with Jeff. You can do whatever. You'll also be immortalized as one of the iconic class characters in our game. But let's be clear here. Jeff will do whatever you want.
I won't shower before or during, though. There are some lines I won't cross.
Fair enough.
Now, you may be wondering about unlocked tiers. We find them distasteful.
You already want this game, As far as we know, you've already killed your family and pets, since those are distractions between you and playing Smug Engine. You don't need extra incentives.
By now, several of you have no doubt begun small cults and sacrifice circles around the game. Pray on, brothers.
So that's the Smug Engine Kickstarter. As always, the only limit to your fun is our imagination. And your wallet.
Mostly your wallet. Support us today. Welcome to Afterthought, the companion podcast System Mastery, where every other week we get together and talk about whatever the hell we want. I'm Jeff. As always, my co-host John is right over there. John, say something that's not just a thick wad of phlegm for everybody, would you? John is sick.
I'm slowly dying.
I've never been happier that our mics are set up about 10 feet apart.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is great.
Don't you worry, though. I'm really good at flicking boogers.
Cripes, don't you dare. And as always, if you need to do anything, do it directly into the mic, people.
Oh, of course.
Because people really want to hear what happens in like the ridges of your esophagus.
Yeah, when something green and nasty is coming up out of me, you'll be the first to know, listeners.
Yeah, and then I'll find out.
Yep, when I flick it at you.
Yes, please do that. Okay, so as I mentioned a second ago, Afterthought is the companion podcast to System Mastery, our RPG review podcast, where every other week we get together and review an old role-playing game for no one's interest. There, up to the minute for 20-year-old games.
Yay.
Yeah. So, John, what horrible old game did we review last week?
Why, we finally did it. We got to the elephant in the room. We did Fatal.
We did. Which, you know, I have to say, kicked off a flurry of people who were concerned for our well-being.
Which, I mean, obviously, I've taken ill and I think Fatal gave me the consumption.
Yeah, I think you're withering away. Ever since we reviewed Fatal, John has consigned himself to walking at night in the rain up on the Lonely Widow's Walk, watching the sea and waiting for the Reaper to claim him.
Yeah, just getting right up to the edge and going, not today, not today.
And I, meanwhile, have become fairly intricate, intimately familiar with, I don't know, strangling animals or something. I'm actually fine. Honestly, it was only bad for that one day right after we had also watched 50 Shades of Grey or 50 Shades Darker.
Yeah.
Just, that was kind of a perfect storm situation.
A real bad confluence.
Yeah. Those two things are not great tastes, and they don't taste great together.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, anyway, we reviewed Fatal, and another thing that's kicked off, in addition to people asking if we're okay, is people trying to send us recommendations for things that are worse than Fatal.
Don't.
Please stop.
just don't.
If we did Fatal as a special joke, we don't want to do racial holy war.
Yeah.
We also got a recommendation. I don't know if you ever heard of the game Mifarog.
Nope.
So Mifarog is written by some manner of Norwegian or Finnish or something murderer.
Oh, okay.
Like literally written by a murderer.
Yeah.
Like an arsonist or something. So... you know, the funny thing is, I've read parts of it, and it's only bad because it was written by a murderer and because it's boring.
Great.
Like, there aren't sections that are like, this is how you commit murders. It's all just like, here is how you roll 3d6 4 stats again.
Yeah.
You can be a peasant, or a noble, or a shit farmer, or a peasant. It's just one of those.
Yeah.
So, anyway. There are a lot of worse games out there, but I am all set. I'm not going to do another horrible game for a long time, I hope. Until, what, like Saturday, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. All right. John, what do you think we should talk about this week?
Well, sir, honestly, the only thing I can talk about right now is, I would say just don't do anything like Fatal.
Just don't do that.
Just please. Please don't.
And in fact, if you did do Fatal, please not have done that.
Please find a time machine and go back and stop yourself.
Oh, he'll just do it right this time. He's got to get it right. He's like, the problem. Oh, I understood. I listened to the review, and the problem was that those racial jokes at the very back of the book were bad. I should put them at the front of the book so that people have time to wear them out a little bit. Kind of get used to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh. There's really not a whole lot of lessons I would want to learn from that book or expound upon further to listeners. I mean, other than negative lessons, you know? If at first you find yourself considering, hey, how much gender disparity do I need to include in my game? The answer's probably not that much.
Yeah, I mean, just, it's like I said during the review, it's all those heartbreakers that we had reviewed before that decided, oh, this isn't realistic enough. I need more stats, more things. And it just took it way too far with way too much gross shit.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think there's ever been a game that took that whole, let's make things more like they really were at the time, and made something useful out of it? Like, especially for medieval setting stuff.
I can't think of anything, because most of the time the person who's writing it is only interested in whatever their particular thing is.
Yeah, they've always got a hang up. It's almost always weapons, but sometimes it's gender disparities or...
Well, it might be like, oh, I'm just super into how, like, the different classes of people were and how, like, someone would make X amount of money and Y for this.
Yeah, you also get the one that's super, super into Christianity.
Yeah.
And so it'll spend forever explaining the differences between Catholicism and Church of England and have different classes between, like, deacon and archdeacon.
Yeah, the weird specificity for things just makes it all the more glaring when it gets to something else and it's just like, and also there are these, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of like to, not read it, of course, but at least know exists a heartbreaker for everything. Like, literally just every single thing has been broken down into a million sub-rules.
Yeah, it's basically just taking a very in-depth history book and adding dice.
Right. Or how about just a role-playing game in which you play through the single day of a life of a peasant?
Yeah, that's the whole campaign, is one day, getting through that one day.
Yeah, you have to survive one day as a peasant, and the reason that the whole campaign is only one day of a peasant is because every single tiny action that the peasant takes throughout the course of the whole day has unbelievable amounts of die rolls that are required to accomplish it, and sets off an unimaginable number of small repercussions.
Oh, yeah.
You have to do things like, all right, you are attempting to pick up your bowl of gruel. Your air displacement may move a fly 3 inches inside the room near your hand.
Yeah, all just like...
Roll for
right.
The gender of the fly.
Roll for your hand-eye coordination in order to get the spoon to your mouth.
Now, once you get that spoon in your mouth, there is a chance you will get a splinter from the spoon because it is a rough wooden spoon, in accordance with this chart that we rolled earlier.
Roll your mastication skill to see if you are able to correctly chew.
Don't worry, you don't need to chew. It's gruel. But it might not be gruel. What if it's beef steak?
Oh, no.
You have to roll a 1 in 10,000 chance of tasty beeves in there instead of just gruel.
Beeves.
It could be beef from multiple types of cow.
Yeah.
At which point I believe it's either beefs or beeves.
Beeves.
It might also be beaver meat in there. You don't know.
Yeah, you don't know.
I mean, granted, there weren't a lot of beaver meats being eaten by peasants, but hey, peasants will take a beaver if they can get a beaver.
Yeah, maybe you were down by the river.
Yeah, you were down by the river in North America.
Yeah.
As a peasant.
As a peasant in North America.
Yeah, and you got yourself some beaver meat.
Yeah.
But you know, the problem with that is then you're just going to get beaver fever, which of course you're going to again have to roll on a chart to see if you get beaver fever.
Yeah, and then you got to follow that beaver around and scream whenever it does anything and buy all its albums. Be a beaver.
Oh, God, wait a minute. You're doing a Justin Bieber thing.
I am.
You know, it's weird because I remember seeing the Belieber joke for Justin Bieber fans.
Yeah.
But I don't think I ever saw Bieber fever written down anywhere.
Oh, yeah. Bieber fever was everywhere.
It was a thing? Okay. I must have just completely missed it. Much like how I have never heard the song Friday.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed not.
It was hard, let me tell you, to never hear the song Friday.
Given that once that became knowledge to your girlfriend, she would always attempt to get you to listen to it.
There was literally one time where she put it on her cell phone in a car and I pulled over and got out. I think I've heard like the first two notes of the song. And it wasn't like I care. It's not like I'm violently against the song, although I'm sure if I'd heard it, I would be. It's that I like the notoriety.
Yeah.
I like this little hole in my pop culture knowledge that I never had to hear that song.
Yeah.
By someone. Is it her?
Rebecca Black.
Rebecca Black. There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have never heard it.
I have several times.
And is it bad?
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Okay.
I mean, it's about as bad as a song by someone that is not trained to sing will be.
I feel like between the two of us, we have this object lesson that we've learned. I'm better off for not having ever heard Rebecca Black's Friday. I'm doing well. It's a good thing I like the notoriety. I forced you to sit down and watch A Christmas Story, which you had never seen, and your response was just a pronounced meh.
Yep.
Like, it was too late for you. Like you.
No, I saw it and went, meh, that was meh.
Yeah. So it would have been better if you had just never seen it.
Oh, yeah. If I had never seen it, then I'd be like, oh, I'm sure it's great.
You'd have some mystique about you. Look upon him, world, a man who has never seen A Christmas Story. He doesn't know anything about Scott Farkas.
I don't.
He still doesn't, because he pretty much was on his phone the whole time.
Yeah, I just completely checked out of that movie.
I don't blame you. It only works when you have, like, family history with the movie.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is for me. It's like, I just remember watching this with my dad a million times.
Yeah, I got nothing for it. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. All right, well, these are all more fun things to talk about than Fatal.
Yep.
Do you think it was a success, the whole idea of, hey, we'll review this game if you give us a bunch of money, or should we do it again?
I mean, I think it was good to at least put it out there. Like I said, it's sort of in what we do, It is the elephant in the room.
Sure, that's fair. Let me ask you a few more here, John. A lot of this is based on our 2-week timetable. That's what stops us from reviewing games like Fatal, which is 900 or 1,300 pages long, depending on which version of it you try to read.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. How much money would I need you to do in 2 weeks to read Phoenix Command?
A lot.
Yeah?
Like a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about The Returners, which is a Final Fantasy fan RPG that tops out at well over 1,400 pages?
Yeah, I really doubt I would be able to even do that if I wanted to.
Yeah. That's another one that we commonly get requested, is review The Returners, and I'm like, we'd have to shut down the show for like 6 weeks.
Yeah. It's just not viable.
And then the result would us be coming back and saying, wow, the authors of this sure did love Final Fantasy.
Boy, howdy. This has a lot of Final Fantasy in it.
Man, remember that one part of Final Fantasy? That's in here.
Remember when that fantasy was all final? That's there.
It's funny because I wouldn't even... The things that drove me into Final Fantasy are the character developments that I liked and the music. So a role-playing game about it wouldn't have those, and I'd be sad.
Yeah. That's very sad.
It is. It's so sad. I tear up a little bit.
I know.
Yeah.
I know you do. I can see it.
Well, you don't try and taste my tears. You just stay over there sick. So gross. All right. You want to answer some questions from listeners?
Yeah, might as well.
I think it could be a good time. Rather than talking about Fatal, let's dive into something more fun.
Indeed.
You want to take the first one, or do you want me to go?
You go ahead.
You got it. This one comes to us from Durnome.
Oh, boy.
Or maybe it's Durnome?
Durnome.
Yeah, it's Durnome.
Durnome. Durnome.
Yeah, there you go, buddy. That's your name being made fun of. Please enjoy it. Please put an accent mark on that E. Dear Gion and Joef.
Yep.
Yeah, all right. Here are some questions. Number one, if you wanted to give a novel to your 13-year-old niece, what would you give her?
Man, I don't know.
It's a tough one, huh? I would probably go with, tell me if I'm wrong here, the Horned King. It's the first book in the Terran Chronicles of Prydain series.
Yeah, I never read it.
Those were my favorite books when I was 13. I do not much care about gender discrimination when picking out books for kids, especially adventure books like that. They're always fun reads. Plus, you know, Ion Way, or whatever, however the heck you're going to pronounce her name, is a fantastic character for young girls. She's proud. She's fairly dominant. She does a whole lot of interesting. She ends up being this badass wizard, while Taryn remains kind of a bumbling dope all the way through all the books.
There you go.
So yeah. So I'd say the Horned King, and lead that right into the Black Cauldron, which is the second book in the series, and then continue to have her never have to see the Disney movie of the same name.
Sweet.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go ahead and say the Gunslinger. Let's just get into that Dark Tower series.
Yeah. Let's just give her the worst possible books for a little kid to read.
Come on.
A 13-year-old to read.
Well, no, I didn't suggest it.
I'm going to give her Lolita. She might as well know there's creepy dudes named Humbert Humbert out there.
Yeah, just know about it.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Please enjoy this. You know what? Maybe that one's too on the nose and creepy. I'll just give her every other book by Nabokov. That'll be fun. Here, read A Pale Fire.
There you go.
You 13-year-old kid. This is perfect for you.
Here, we'll start you out on the Xanth series.
Oh, my 13-year-old niece, have you ever heard of the Brothers Karamazov? You're about to. Everything by Russians. That's what you're going to read. You want some Dostoevsky?
Sweet.
All right, second question. How do you deal with the grognardy tendencies of friends and family members?
Well, I mean, most of my friends aren't really groggy. And my family doesn't really give a shit about it.
Yeah. No one in my family is a role-playing game type person. In fact, my brother listens to us out of what I assume is just family loyalty, and he's the person who recommended we start reading Star Wars novels.
Yeah, I mean, both my sisters do role-play or have role-played in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But, they've never been so much into role-playing that they would have groggy opinions about things.
So, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you here. This isn't going to be a very useful answer for anyone else, but we do have friends between the two of us that we hang out with at the game nights at our local store who are groggy, and the way I've dealt with them is to develop a successful podcast and then leverage it into beating them into not being groggy anymore.
Huh.
So try that.
Try it.
Try becoming a very, very minor, like, AA-level celebrity who, for some reason, people respect the opinions of, and then browbeat your groggy friends with that. It works pretty well. So that'd be my recommendation for that. And then finally, number one again, a train is hurtling down the tracks. So I guess it's bouncing?
Yeah, it's hurtling.
Yeah, it's hurtling down the tracks. You stand at junction and are capable of switching the tracks. Down one track lies a passenger van filled with 3.5E D&D evangelists. On the other track is a table filled with a plate, artisanal hot dogs, and quick pickles, and a pint of your favorite beverage. Do you eat the hot dog? Okay, first of all, stop everything, hold the presses. What's a quick pickle?
I was literally about to go, wait, what the fuck is a quick pickle?
I'm not a huge fan of regular pickles, but what if quick pickles are amazing?
Dude, quick pickles.
I don't know what that is, and I'm on board with it.
I love pickles.
Yeah?
And the idea of a quick pickle sounds great to me.
Yeah, you're like, I'm already at the point where I'm shoving the hot dogs off the table.
Yeah, I am into this quick pickle.
I don't know what it is. Let's just take a second here to really get into it and theorize about what a quick pickle is. Because, again, no research.
I mean, honestly, it kind of sounds like a weapon I would get in a Mega Man game.
Okay, yeah, definitely. Or the boss you would have to fight to get his weapon.
Yeah.
You'd have to, yeah, you have, after I, you finish
I fought
fighting,
quick pickle.
Yeah, I've already defeated Boomer Kowanger, which means I have the weapon I need to destroy quick pickle. I got, I don't know, quick brine. It shoots a blast of brine that instantly pickles any robot. Those little helmet dudes are so pickled now.
I'm pickled.
Three little bullets.
God, any powers.
Aside from the fact that quick pickle sounds like an awesome thing, or I'd even just like to have quick pickle on a shirt.
Yeah.
Okay, so are you guessing that this guy's from some other country, which is why quick pickle is like... Maybe that's an Australian thing.
Yeah, maybe some other place is like, yeah, quick pickle, obviously.
Of course we have, everyone here eats quick pickle all the time.
Obviously.
You eat quick pickle between 11sies and tuppence upon the moors.
Clearly.
Duh. You pick it up at a Tesco's.
Yeah, you get that toad in a basket and quick pickles, and then you're off to the races.
Yeah, quick pickle. Anyway, I probably save the people. I'm more of an aficionado of hot dog questions than actual hot dogs myself. Now, if the table had been ladled heavily with quick pickle and hot dog questions. But the thing is, I'm not actually... I think
the question doesn't say who you'll save. It just wants to know if you will eat the hot dog.
Oh, good point. Good point. They're artisanal hot dogs, and they're served with something called quick pickle and a pint of my favorite beverage.
Yeah.
My favorite beverage is rum, so a pint of rum is pretty rad.
My favorite beverage is... millions of dollars.
Well, you get a pint of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
But you have to drink it.
No, I mean, it doesn't say I have to. It just says that there's a pint of it.
Yeah, but I know all the rules.
All of them.
I'm the one who asked the hot dog question.
Well, I mean, I could probably pass a millions of dollars, a pint of millions of dollars.
All right. So what are we going with here, John? Do you eat the hot dog?
Oh, yeah.
Do you also save the passengers?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, I mean, people keep thinking that because we're 4th edition fans, that we must, by default, hate 3rd edition type people. But what I keep telling people is, that's not a real war. It's okay to like both games.
It is. But no one does.
That's true. No one actually likes both games. I like both. They're fine.
No, you don't.
No, they're fine.
Don't lie to the people.
Dude, 3rd edition is fine. The only problem with 3rd edition is if people go on the internet and read all the shit that you can do with it and then do it. Because all the things you can do with it that are stupid are things that your DM would have to be like a total idiot to let you do.
Yes.
See, they'd be like, my character takes plus 88 in jumping and uses that for arguing. And if your DM's like, well, my hands are tied because it's in the book.
Yeah, technically it works. I guess you can do it.
Yeah, then your DM is already screwed up. And at that point, your DM is the problem.
Yeah.
So third edition is fine. All right, so I guess that's, let's see. Oh, love the show from Durndome.
Wow.
What you got, John? It's your turn.
All right. This one is from William Skelton.
Oh, no, a skeleton?
Oh, no, Bill Skeleton.
A spooky skeleton is asking
spooky,
us a question.
Spooky, scary skeleton wants to ask a question.
There's shivers down my spine.
So, out of all the RPGs you guys have reviewed, which ones should I scavenge the local used bookstores for?
Oh, well, dude, Vanishing Point for sure, because it's worth a bunch of money.
Yeah, and then I mean, I definitely say Feng Shui, because yeah. That's fun.
Speaking of which, we have two copies of that, so we should probably give one away at some point.
I mean, probably.
Yeah, we'll announce that contest any day now.
Any day.
You can win a copy of first edition Feng Shui if you...
We'll announce that every day. We won't do it, but we'll announce it.
The first person to mail us 200 UPCs
yeah.
receives Feng Shui.
The first person to mail us 200 APCs.
Yeah, we need 200 armored personnel carriers.
Yep.
And you'll receive One Night with Jeff and a copy of Feng Shui.
Yeah, One Night with Jeff makes the hard man humble.
Is that me? No, wait, I'm a very soft man.
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. Yeah, I mean, of the games that we've reviewed that are legitimately good, I would again go with Vanishing Point, or I'd say if you find used Gamma World, you buy that shit.
Yeah, definitely that. Anything else that I've actually really enjoyed? I mean, I would probably go find a copy of Haven, City of Violence.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, you should get that.
Everyone should own that. Yeah. It's the masterwork of Lewis Porter Jr.
Indeed.
Yeah. So if you ever see that on the shelf, a copy of Haven, City of Violence, you buy that immediately. All right, let's see. Next question comes to us from one Johnny Canuck. And he says, Dear Jib and Jab, the Jebbit Brothers. Oh, okay, well, this is a car talk thing. Great. Dear Jib and Jab, the Jebbit Brothers, my wife drives a 2007 Honda Fit, the first Fit model to the market. And over the past few months, it's developed a number of weird problems. Odd rattles under the dash, the radio switching stations suddenly, the time the airbags deployed and were full of knives. The car currently has about 106,000 miles on it. Do you think it's time to look at trading her in, or are these common annoyances that we can fix ourselves, seeing as how we're well out of warranty?
He also says that, oddly enough, all of this started happening after he accidentally fed his pet Mogwai after midnight, but he is sure there is no actual correlation between these two events.
No, I must have completely missed that paragraph.
Yep.
All right, so let's see. A 2007 Honda Fit's making a bunch of noise. Also, there's knives in the airbag. Okay, so here's the first question I'm going to ask you. Have you noticed any sort of accumulation of residue on the interior of the front windshield? What you're going to want to do is check that closely. And if there's any kind of resinous matter or residue building up on the top front, or front of the top, inside of the front windshield, what you're going to realize right away is that your car is borked because your steam systems are broken.
Yeah.
And they're venting a thick resinous steam that's eventually going to coat the inside of your car and your lungs and will eventually encase you in a thick resinous permanent amber. You'll be killed. Yes, you'll definitely be killed.
Yeah.
As for your Mogwai, you're right. It's completely unrelated. Your Mogwai is going to be fine. Just reset it using a paperclip. You'll find a hole at the base of its neck. You're going to want to stick that paperclip tip about 3 inches directly into the base of your Mogwai's neck. Hold that there for 3 seconds. It will thrash about violently. After a while there, it'll either reset or die.
You know, one or the other.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, either way, your problem solved.
Yeah. All right. Great.
All right. So, God damn it. From Gaming Hipster, Jeff, could you please rant about those Chevy ads for a while? And don't let John stop you no matter what. Turn off his mic if you have to.
Oh, well, gee. I don't know. Am I going to have to turn off your mic?
I mean, maybe.
So, let's get right down to it. Before every movie we've ever watched in theaters on the show, we have to watch one of those goddamn Chevy commercials. And you know the ones we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, if you've gone to a movie in a theater in the last, like, 2 years, you have seen this.
They're on daytime TV, too, but they use a slightly different set. But it's the same bullshit. It's some spokesman who is the smarmiest douchebag in the world, and you know he's got a made-up hipster name. His parents gave him. There's no way his name isn't Brad Chester. He's like, I'm Brad Chester Thorne. I have a waxed mustache and suspenders on, and I have a hip opinion about IPA-type beers. Anyway, are you guys super impressed by JD and Power Associates trophies? Who has ever been impressed by those trophies that is not in the auto industry?
Well, I mean, I think if someone was like, hey, we've got J.D. Power and Associate trophies, they're like, that probably means something.
I feel like that means about as much as if I were to haul my War Machine and 40K tournament trophies into a job interview.
Well, if your job was to interview for playing fucking Warhammer, then yeah, sure.
No, I feel like it's the opposite, because no one gives a fuck about J.D. Power and Associate. Like, unless your job was literally, like, advertising to be an auto executive, or like a, or specifically to be an auto advertising executive, and how would you sell cars to people? Well, I'd constantly mention these piece of shit brown trophies that are always in TV commercials that mean nothing to anyone. This one says best safety rating in a mid-sized sedan that's definitely the Chevy Nova. Or whatever. Every time, it's the same shit. It's it seems like there are about 40 million of these trophies, and they only exist for car commercials, and I hate them. And in the meantime, all we're seeing is five people stand around with Brad Chester Thorne, public announcer, as he does something ridiculous that is for some reason supposed to be impressive. Like, what if I told you that a garage door in this giant garage was going to open? And they all go, wow, that's a lot of cars back there. And then he says things like, what if I told you safety? And one of them says, I think I'd feel a lot more safe in that situation. I feel like Chevy cars would make my dick bigger.
I have to imagine that the people they get in there, because they're like, oh, these aren't actors.
They have to say that. They say these aren't actors.
But I have to imagine it's just like people they found outside in Hollywood who are like trying to be extras and things.
Oh, guaranteed. I mean, remember that one time where you went to go be an extra by being an audience member in some dumb game show?
Oh, yeah. And I've done that actually a few times where I've just been like some extra in some bullshit.
Yeah. And the other people you meet there are like, oh, I'm a professional extra, but I've got dreams of being a real actor.
Yeah. They're like, oh, this is like the fifth game show I've been to today.
And the way you get real jobs is to plaster on the biggest, dumbest, fakest smile in the world and say ridiculous shit about Chevy.
Yeah.
You have to say things like, I feel more manly just looking at it. I get first dibs on that Chevy Vera Cruz or whatever the fuck. I don't know what a Chevy car is called, because never once has any one of those commercials impugned upon me a desire to learn more about Chevy or about J.D. Power and Associates. All I've learned is that people are easily impressed by doors and that there's crazy warehouses somewhere with giant chain things that range platforms out of the ground.
Yeah, I'm like, man, you spent so much on that. And if I was there, I'd be like, huh. That lift is rad. Like, I wouldn't give a fuck about the cars. I'd be like, dude, that's a rad lift you got.
I feel like there's probably, I'd say maybe 75% of people that they actually run through their commercial. Because the other thing you can tell about those fucking pieces of shit is that it's clearly like 40 people in every commercial, because it takes that many to get five of them to say something stupid.
Yeah.
So that means that the other 75% of them are saying things like, whoa, that lift is cool. Or yeah, these doors are stupid. Or I like Ford. Because there's got to be one in every group that's fouling it for everybody.
Well, I mean, I figure there's got to be at least one person that when he's like, what would you say if I told you J.D. Power and Associate has given Chevy more awards than anyone else? They go, eh.
Yeah, that's, I feel like everyone would say that. You get 15 people saying, I don't know. And then the last guy would be like, I hate J.D. Power and Associates. Like, one in a thousand times you're going
to. Who actually has enough care to hate J.D. Power and Associates?
Me?
Aside from a weirdo like you.
Here's my ultimate goal in life, John. I want to win $1 million in a lottery, buy J.D. Power and Associates, and shut it down. I just want to turn it. We will no longer be giving out trophies. We will still exist as an organization for nebulous and unknown reasons.
Nah, man, just give out trophies, but for shit that's just weird. Like
participation.
Just handing out, like, best rabbit.
The best rabbit goes to, I don't know.
I went to my local county fair and handed out a J.D. Power and Associate Award.
No, fuck that.
To my favorite rabbit.
I'm going to give it to the Hyundai Sonata.
Best rabbit.
Best rabbit is definitely this car. Use that in a commercial, you pieces of shit.
Well, they would. They'd just be like, oh, the Sonata got a J.D. Power and Associates Award.
Don't ask which one.
Don't worry about it.
It's definitely not best rabbit. You know what? Fuck them then. I'm going to make it worst rabbit.
Best place to bone.
Most likely car to be stolen. Best car to steal.
Car most likely to be an Autobot.
This one wins the J.D. Power and Associate for these are the instructions on how you get its gas cap open and poop in there. Anyway, I feel like that's probably my Chevy rant for now.
Probably. He also asks, what's your favorite Akewood strip and what is your favorite Akewood event?
Okay, and he also says there that his was a he likes the GOF or the Great Outdoor Fight, which everyone loves. It's a fantastic event.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as events go, that would probably be up there.
Yeah, definitely up there. He also says his favorite strip is the one about depression, and I know that one. It's the one that's like fall memories, and it's roast beef getting fed jelly beans because he's too depressed to get out of bed. It's got a very sad ending where he's like, sometimes love is wondering if you've trapped an innocent person.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one because it's very downbeat and sad, which is one of the things about Akewood I like.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I'm going to say my favorite strip in Akewood is the Teodoro one where he wakes up without having rent to pay. So he goes off to sell sandwiches at a construction site and accidentally gives a construction worker a sandwich with dog penis medicine instead of mayonnaise. Because the one line of, what you all about, playa, this tastes like dog penis medicine, is one of my favorite lines of all time. And my favorite event in it is the secret gay porn DVD case arc. Because I don't know what it is about great, great, great from the finish that just has never stopped appealing to me.
I want to say, I'm going to go Great Outdoor Fight for my favorite event.
Oh, the Great Outdoor Fight is one of the greatest moments in webcomics.
But the best strip, I kind of want to go with Nice Pete describing killing someone as a basketball game.
And my opponent is there.
I am there, and my opponent is there.
And then I put his body in my van.
And I am the winner.
So,
like, I love that so much.
Yeah, he just has a real knack for turns of phrase that I really appreciate.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm definitely going to go with the Teodoro selling dog penis medicine to construction workers. And yeah, the secret gay porn DVD case arc.
There you go.
So for people who are not fans of Akewood, sorry for this last question. It
that
was very
must have
confusing.
Sounded like a lot of nonsense.
Yeah. And for people who are fans of Akewood but have not obsessively memorized the 13 years of its history, that was probably a lot of nonsense. All right. Let's see here. I've got Pawn Dreams who says, hi. So I just have one for Jeff. Having listened to the Chevy bit. Oh, sweet. Let's do the Chevy bit again, John. There were five questions about the Chevy bit, John. I only included
just so you know.
I only included these two. I was planning to do a thing where I layered them all in there, like the end of one of those honest trailers.
Uh-huh.
But we're running low on time, so I really need to ask you if you're actually me. Like, I'm seriously questioning if I am somehow fight clubbing my way into podcasting. Someone who has a similar opinion about the Chevy bit. I've landed on the following question as a Mandela effect litmus test: where was that girl on the train that you kissed from originally? Let's see here. Yours, a different Jeff, somewhere on the East Coast. Oh, well, I spell my name with one F. I've never been in a train on the East Coast, and I have never kissed anyone on a train.
Have I ever kissed anyone on a train?
I've only been on a train like four times.
Well, I mean, I assume you would include things like BART and stuff like that.
Oh, see, now I don't know that I would. I'm counting train as literally a train from one city to another city.
No,
I'm
counting train.
I know you can take BART
to
Oakland, but you're counting anything that's like a vehicle that travels on tracks?
Yes.
All right. In that case, yes, I probably kissed someone on a train, and I have been on trains in the East Coast.
What about like that train in Disneyland?
Last time I was in Disneyland, I was 15. I've never gone with anyone but my parents, and I'm pretty sure I've never kissed anyone there.
What about when you were a child and you were on Casey Jr. in Disneyland?
What about Big Thunder Mountain? Have you kissed anyone on Big Thunder Mountain?
Huh? What about that?
How about all the Disney trains?
Every
you know what?
Disney
just,
train.
Just Disney rides. Have you kissed anyone on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, John?
Who hasn't?
I mean, I've definitely kissed everyone on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
Every single person there.
It took a lot of work, but I made it happen.
Boy, howdy. I just sat at the exit and kissed everyone on their way out.
Man, I just got on one of those people movers back before they got rid of them and just sat there with a sign that said, you have to kiss me to get out of this people mover. And it worked. It worked
so
well.
Oh, it worked.
Yeah.
His gangbusters.
So there's my litmus mandala test for you there, other Jeff. Have you ever taken a sign into a people mover in Disneyland before they got rid of them that said, everyone who wants out of this people mover has to kiss me?
You know it's yes.
Haven't we all?
Come on.
Every Jeff has done that. Jeff Foxworthy, Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, all of them. All the famous Jeffs of history.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Yep, all of them.
All of them.
All the Jeffs.
Yep, that's a thing that we all do. All right, so there we go. I think we're probably different people. I don't think I haven't done a lot of train kissing.
a lot of train kissing.
I'm pretty. And not only that, but I don't know where the people I've kissed on trains are from. Mostly because I don't ask a lot of questions, and then I get off at a different stop than them.
Yeah, you do. Heyo.
You know how it is.
All right, next one from Mirror to Drek. One, what the hell is it with fascist states and RPGs slowly turning into good guys due to writers writing them that way more and more over the years? See the Imperium of Man and the Coalition from Rifts. Mostly because the fascist
cool.
Well, yeah, I was going to say mostly because the fascist states in RPGs are almost always badass military guys.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing that RPG people love, it is badass military guys.
Right. You can tell in that first Rifts book that the Coalition is unavoidably the bad guys.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can tell from the moment you see the name of their leader and it's like Josef Karl Prosek or something. You're like, oh, these are the bad guys. All right. But over the course of time, they've been like, all right, their skull armor just gets cooler and cooler looking.
We make it sleeker and more badass.
It's all polished. Eventually, they all look like they're wearing skull iPod armor.
Huh.
That's what Coalition War Campaign is. 40K, I don't know. I feel like I've never been a fan of that. 40K making its slow switch over from parody to fetishism has been one of my least favorite things about that hobby.
Well, yeah, because eventually it gets to the point where you're like, well, yeah, but the Imperium of Man might be bad, but what about Tyranids? They're saving everyone from that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point, like, way back in the 80s where 40K was, like, all a big joke.
Yeah.
And all that Space Marines fascism was basically, like, the paranoia RPG taken to an illogical extreme.
Yeah.
But by the time we've hit now, it's straight up every book that comes out is just another blowjob for Space Marines.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even if it got slightly serious, it would be more like Judge Dredd than anything.
Yeah.
But now it's just straight up like, oh, Space Marines are the best. They're so cool. And the God Emperor of Man called up and said, ooh, Ultramarines, you are so muscly.
Would you like to be on my task force for getting handjobs on a water slide?
Yeah.
That's what's happened to Space Marines. They've turned they've switched from parody to fetishism right back into parody, but not on purpose this time. But yeah, it's just time plus cool-looking weapons. That's
yep.
The answer.
And number two, if the Proclaimers would 500 miles and then walk 500 miles more, and Vanessa Carlton would walk 1,000 miles tonight, what time would they meet in the middle, and would they be able to catch the midnight train to Georgia?
Well, let's see. Vanessa Carlton is saying that she will walk 1,000 miles that night.
Yeah, that night.
Like, specifically, she's saying, I will walk 1,000 miles tonight.
Yeah.
So we're establishing that Vanessa Carlton is real goddamn fast, giving her a reasonable chance to actually catch the midnight train to Georgia in a single evening.
Well, that depends on the speed we're talking here. I mean, if it's a single night, then I feel like if she was going quick but not, like, the Flash level speed, then
mm-hmm.
maybe, like, 4 in the morning would be, like, the time she'd get there.
That is kind of a thing, isn't it? She's saying she'll walk 1,000 miles tonight, and tonight pretty much implies till daytime.
Yeah.
So it probably starts around 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then goes till like 4 or 5 in the
yeah,
morning.
Yeah, sundown to sunup is
yeah.
what I'm thinking.
Oh, you're right. You're right. And that also has to take into account whether it's winter or summer, how long that particular night is. That's definitely controlling the speed of Vanessa Carlton anyway. Vanessa Carlton, by definition from this song, is faster in the summer than she is in the winter.
Now, she might be able to catch the midnight train to Georgia, though,
mm-hmm.
because the Proclaimers have no specific time limit on their 1,000 miles.
Also,
just that they would walk 500 and then 500 more.
Yeah, so they'd be willing to walk 500 miles, stop for a bit, get a nosh or something, and then walk an additional 500 miles. But I feel like they're never going to catch that train to Georgia because aren't the Proclaimers in Scotland?
I mean, yeah, but they didn't say where they were going to start walking from. I mean, neither did Vanessa Carlton, to be
okay.
fair.
Okay, so let's assume that they're both willing to walk 1,000 miles.
Let's assume they
evening.
Both start 1,000 miles away from the midnight train to Georgia, wherever that happens to be.
Well, that's another thing that you really have to take into account, is that it's not the midnight train from Georgia.
Exactly.
It's the midnight train to Georgia, so we have no idea where it starts.
I mean, it could be something, like, super close. You could be talking like, oh, yeah, it's in Mississippi.
It's the midnight train to Georgia from Georgia, the suburbs. Okay, let's say it's the midnight train to Georgia, and it starts from Scotland.
Okay.
Okay, so the midnight train to Georgia starts in Edinburgh at midnight.
Okay, but where's Vanessa Carlton coming from?
Okay, Vanessa Carlton, I don't know anything about. I don't even know what that 1,000-mile song is. Oh, wait, no, I just remembered it. Okay, I'm up to speed on that. So she's going to start in, I'm going to say...
I mean, Europe is tiny, which means if you're in, like, Scotland, you're going to have to be starting from, like, France or something.
Well, no, they don't. Okay, so here's an important thing about the Proclaimers. They aren't going to walk 500 miles and then walk 500 more. They specifically would.
Well, they the other thing is to. They could walk 500 miles away from that midnight train and then 500 miles back.
Oh, they could even start at its starting point, couldn't they? Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. That is the thing. Here's the thing about the Proclaimers song. They're not saying anything especially romantic. All they're doing is establishing an upper limit on their willingness to walk.
Yeah.
Vanessa Carlton is actually saying...
It's like one of those 99 cent and up stores.
Yeah.
You're like, come on, all you're telling me is nothing is below 99 cents.
Yeah, other stores might have stuff that's below 99 cents, but not you, 99 cents and up.
Fuck you, 99 cent and up store.
All you've done is set a sales floor.
Yeah.
I want to know what your upper limit price is. And with the Proclaimers, they tell you they will not walk 501 miles and then an additional 501 miles just to be the man who's coming home to you.
Indeed not.
They've just given you a limit.
Yes.
So in summation, fuck the Proclaimers. I'm just kidding. That's the best song ever. And that Vanessa Carlton song.
Meh.
Eh, it's all right. It sounds like a shampoo commercial. So, all right. Next question comes to us from Fuzzy Gundam, who says, would you rather be able to automatically know what is wrong with any electronic device and what to do about it, or be able to skip to the front of any queue with everyone magically being okay with it?
I'm going to go with the first.
Being able to understand what's wrong, but not necessarily... Oh, what to do about
it. And what to do about
it. And what to do about it.
Because now I've got a career.
What if what to do about it is don't bother? Because, I mean, I feel like that's already how your life works. Like, this is John already has this power. What's wrong with this electronic device? I don't know. It's broken. What should I do about it? I don't know. Play video games.
Toss it. Leave it. And I'll pull up quick to retrieve it.
This thing's broken. What should I do? Eat Jack in the Box. Watch YouTube videos.
What you're going to want to get is a Jumbo Jack.
No tomatoes. The planet hates tomatoes. Let's see. I'm going to say be able to skip to the front of any line with everyone magically being okay with it.
Like, that's useful, but man, being able to be like, oh, I'm just a repairman now.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, that's the thing is, I'm already fairly handy, but I mean, electronic device does offer you a wide range of fascinating options. I
oh,
mean,
yeah.
That includes like computers and stuff. But here's the thing that I'm thinking. That gives me one magical day a year where I could just fuck with everyone at Black Friday. Now, up until now, I've invariably just skipped Black Friday because, you know, I hate it. And I want those poor people to be able to go home on Thanksgiving instead of having to be there at 4 p.m. the day before.
Yep.
But in this situation, I'd be like, no, sweet, I want that $200 TV that's the one thing that they sell every year.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with it. I'm going
to
go.
They always have like three of.
Yeah. And then I'm going to find other ways to use it to make other people's lives miserable.
Good.
Well, I mean, notably, I feel like that's going to automatically come with me always being the first to call shotgun.
Hmm. But that's not a line.
It's a form of a line.
No, it isn't. There's no line forming up to get into the front door.
It's a verbal line. It's a similarity.
Nope.
Yeah, I'm calling the rules on this. First of all, you don't know. All you know is what's wrong with electronic devices. I'm the one who knows everything about lines now. I'm sorry, cues.
Exactly. Now, you don't know everything about them. You can just skip to the front.
Also, I can skip to the front of cues, which are not lines.
Indeed.
They are different things. I get the ability to skip to the front of cues, and I'm going to say shotgun counts as cueing.
Nah. Nah.
Oh, like you know.
Oh, I know. Unless you have a system set up where it's like, okay, so John gets shotgun today, and then Jeff gets it tomorrow, and then... We'll have a swapping system, and then you go, okay, but I want to be at the front of that line of when you get to go in. Then you can jump that. But if it's just who calls it first, that's not a line. That's dibs. Dibs is not a cue.
I think this is just going to end up being a hot dog sandwich question for us. All right. I guess you're up.
All right. Neil Anderson asks.
No, it's Neil and her son.
Neil and her son.
There you go.
Neil Anderson.
Yeah, that's what it is. Neil Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right. As I have been listening to your backlog of podcasts, I listened to the Discworld episode and then one where you mentioned Batman, Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and gorillas, so it got me thinking, how would superheroes work in Discworld? Ironically?
Yeah, they'd pretty much just... It'd be a deconstruction, because everything in Discworld is.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they have not had that yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pratchett was more about deconstructing modern life than, like...
Well, I mean, there are a few that deconstruct modern pop culture tropes. You know, you've got soul music.
Yeah.
You've got... I forget the name of the one that's about movie making.
Yeah, moving pictures.
Thank you. So there are a few where he picks apart, like, I'm just amazed that there isn't, for example, a Discworld Batman analog.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I said, it's more about stuff from the modern day, or a lot of the earlier stuff is going to be deconstructing fantasy tropes.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not so much about that. I mean, you've got a few that would almost
I was just about
be
to say,
that.
Vimes is basically the superhero of Discworld.
Oh, I was going to say, honestly, probably Vetinari is the closest you're going to get to Batman in that universe.
Yeah, I mean, he's really more of an Ozymandias type. But, you know, Vimes has those ones where he's, like, just casually shutting down assassins that are coming to kill him and so on.
Yeah, I mean, you've also got Kohan the Barbarian.
Yeah, and Teotime.
So, you know, you've got people that are badasses, but not so much superheroes. I think how it would work would probably end up being someone accidentally stopping a crime while wearing a costume going to a costume party.
Yeah, I was about to say, it would probably be like Carrot stops some crime while he's got a towel tied around his neck for some reason.
Yeah.
And then everyone starts calling him, you know, Captain Carrot Man or something, and he's like, please stop that, I'm just Carrot Iron Founderson. and that's pretty much the whole story, is a legend springs up around some minor character.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Carrot's not a minor character, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Is just some weird misunderstanding that then gets blown out of proportion.
It'd be Nobbs. That's who it would happen to. Nobbs would be trying to pilfer some laundry, and then he'd accidentally stop a crime, and the next thing you know, he's like the troll of... trolls are a thing there. He'd end up being like the Batman because he was carrying a bat at the time. Yeah. So that's how it would work. Dan Kobe asks, hey guys, I just finished the Fatal episode, and it reminds me of a dilemma that I have. Whenever I run into a Byron Hall type, which is a lot more often now that we've elected one, and his supporters have crawled out of their basements, I feel an emotion that is a mixture of contempt, pity, disgust with myself for feeling pity, disgust at them for being so loathsome, and resentment that they are making me feel pity for them. Can you help me name this emotion?
I feel like I would be better at helping name this emotion if I was German.
Yeah? You'd probably come up with some word like, you know, like Schlauchtenstein or something?
Oh, yeah. I'd probably take like four different words that exist, smash them together, and go, there you are.
Yeah, well, we could just do that in English. It'll just be the first person to ever use English like German. We'll just call it pity... loath disgust. It doesn't really work, does it?
No, it doesn't.
I'm going to go with Merg.
Merg.
Because Merg is always how I feel when I have to interact with someone like that. I'm always, in my head, I'm just going, Merg. That's you're Merging in those situations because you feel so Merg about everything.
You gotta Merg up.
Yeah, you got to quit. You tell these people to quit being so Mergy. I don't know if that's a really good word. I apologize if it isn't.
That's fine.
It's spelled with no vowels, by the way.
None.
No, it's M-R-R-R-G-H.
Merg.
Merg. It's the same. It's a similar noise to the noise you make when you realize that the last grape in your pile of grapes you're eating is like a little shitty grape.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to eat that little shitty grape anyway because you're hungry and it's going to taste like shit and it's going to ruin the rest of the grapes you just ate. And you're like, merg. It's the same thing. Yeah, so that's the noise.
There you go.
All right.
So, from Phaedrus Sales. Dear Chief Justice Marshall, in Marbury versus Madison, you established the ability of the Supreme Court to conduct judicial review over law. Since this is not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, don't you think you have usurped authority not granted you by our founding document? Also, would you have scraped the First Amendment if you had read Fatal?
Well, speaking as Chief Justice Marshall, if I may.
If you may.
I'm going to go ahead and say that while there are some issues that arose from that oversight, it was 1803, and goddamn if I was going to let that shitty little Marbury get his writ of mandamus under my authority. Fuck that guy.
Fucking Marbury.
There have been some problems that have come up since then, but one thing that was for goddamn sure was that I was not going to let that guy be appointed a judge by a new Congress immediately after a president had changed power, I think. I don't know. I don't remember what Marbury versus Madison is. I think I'm closer than most people would be able to do off the top of their head, though.
Probably.
I mean, I remember the term writ of mandamus. Someone mail me some goddamn ice cream.
Yeah, please mail him ice cream.
All right, so let's see. Also, would I have scrapped the First Amendment if I had read Fatal? I don't know. I feel like that in this one rare situation... Fatal exists as an example of how great America is, because even an absolute degenerate shithead weasel can write whatever the fuck they want, and it's okay. No one will arrest them. Although, I've got to say, Byron Hall is one of those people that you should punch in the face if you can.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying do it. Don't do that.
I'm not saying do punch him, but if you happen to be near him.
Yeah, and then someone else punches him, that's great.
Yeah.
Just don't do it, though. I'm not giving you that specific instruction because I don't want legal trouble.
Don't do that.
Do not
seek him out and punch him in the face.
No one punch Byron Hall in the face, and no one step on his First Amendment rights. He's allowed to write whatever gross things he wants, and there's always a chance that he gets punched.
Always.
In the face. All right, let's see. Nameless Nick 01 says, Jeff and John, spelled correctly, very nice. After listening to Over the Edge and Nephilim, I started thinking. Both of those games do interesting stuff with alternate history settings, but don't seem to play particularly easily. I know 2nd edition Nephilim had its fans, though. What makes a good alternate history? A good alternate history setting to play in, and what are the usual mistakes of doing so?
I think doing the alternate history stuff is super interesting. I love alternate history.
Oh, it's always a lot of fun. I think the problem is that 90% of the time you see anyone try alternate history, it's what if the bad guys won?
Yeah.
It's like the only thing you ever see.
No. Like, almost always that. There have been some really cool ones. There was one where it was basically that the African nations had colonized into Europe instead, and they went to the New World, so you had the entire slave trade of basically, like, people from Britain, essentially, happening, and it was an interesting alternate universe, and I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's, to me, that wouldn't even be all that super exciting, because it's just backwards. Because there's a lot of those that are like that, where it's like, what if white people were the slaves? And it's like, to me, one of the ones I've always really enjoyed is, what if the gunshot that had killed Kennedy had instead just paralyzed him? Because it's not necessarily about who's a good guy or who's a bad guy. And what the idea is that Kennedy was straight up obsessed with the space race, where Nixon thought it was a shitty idea.
Yeah.
It's because of Nixon that we got the space shuttle, which, you know, ultimately was cool looking, and when you were a little kid, you loved them, but they're just buses that can get you into orbit. You can't do anything cool with a space shuttle other than carry people up into space. Rockets were the shit, because rockets could get us to places.
Yes.
So if Kennedy had been alive and had not had the space race replaced, we'd be on Mars by now, and that'd be a really cool alternate history. So that's a thing I've always liked to think about is, what if some critical figure had not died?
Yeah.
When they die early, or when they, like, what if Tesla hadn't died, for example? Then he wouldn't be venerated by nerds everywhere, because he'd be seen as the easily discredited sham artist he actually was. Suck my dick, the oatmeal. The end. All right, so there you go. Those are some good alternate history settings. I mean, I'm not sure how you'd play in, you know, rockets got really great and now we're on Mars, but that's one of the ones I've always liked.
Yeah.
Also, what if dinosaurs hadn't gone extinct and everyone had one?
What if? What if I was a Bronchosaurus Rex?
What if Pokemon were real? That's an alternate history, right?
Yeah.
Sure. And Team Rocket had to hang out with me at Carl's Jr.
What if?
That's an alternate history I'd like to envision. What was the other half of his question? Number two, after reading over all of these RPGs, you get approached by a producer. He's looking to make a TV show. So, hey, we have been approached by a producer, and he was looking to make a TV show. Not with us, though.
No.
All right. Somehow, though, he's a Japanese producer looking to greenlight an anime based on either of your two lives or an RPG you've reviewed. What oddly specific anime genre do you choose? What dumb licensed merchandise do you sell to your weirdo collectors?
It's mine. It's my life.
Okay, so the primary thing we're going to sell is body pillows that are the exact size and shape of John.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the one.
And well, it's my life because it's going to be one of those shitty slice of life ones.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's going to be my life because it's now or never.
Lol.
No, all right. So we're going to go with John's shitty slice of life anime. And most episodes are going to feature him not even getting out of bed.
Yeah, it'll have those things where, like, you get that anime scene where you sit up and you're like, huh. And then you just go back into bed.
Eating an entire apple, including the core. So you're going to go with your life as a shitty slice of life anime.
Yeah.
You have to do the thing where you introduce one supernatural power that for some reason never comes up.
Oh, yeah. No, like, I mean, the whole thing is going to end up being like some weird, I mean, obviously some weird harem thing.
Yeah.
Where like a bunch of girls are like, ooh, and then I just don't care.
Well, I always say that because I have my buddy who's an anime distributor. Like her whole job, she's an anime importer. and she's often watching DVDs that she's purchased so that she can like check them for specificity or so she can label the other ones that she has correctly. I was over at her house one day helping her with some project or something, and she had Fruits Basket on in the background.
Yeah.
And Fruits Basket is a boring slice of life anime about high school kids who love each other or something.
Yep.
And I watched with her in the background 5 episodes of Fruits Basket. And at a certain point, I asked her, what the shit is the point of this show? And she says, oh, all these characters can turn into creatures from the Zodiac. And I was like, the fuck they? If they could do that, they would have done that. They don't do that ever. That's nope. Not a thing that has. So that's that for me, that's what slice of life anime is. A show where characters have cool superpowers and they ignore them because of sensei.
Yeah.
So that's pretty great. Good job for you.
Yeah.
It'll be the slice of life anime starring John. And it'll just be called Guren John Gon. Or no, Guren La John. That's better.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the one. All right. Thanks, Nameless Nick.
All right. Oh, we got another one from Dank Obi.
Oh, I should have put those two together.
Aw, so Dank Obi.
So Dank Obi-Wan says,
hi, guys. I'm not trying to pit you two against each other, but if you had to stat each other out using any RPG system you've reviewed, what would your race, class, alignment, and other prominent stats be? Well, I'm pretty sure Jeff would be a bugbear with an 18-inch asshole.
And I'm pretty sure, and John, you're going to have to help me out here because I can't remember. Just tell me, which one of the races in Vanishing Point represented crippling depression?
I can't remember, but I do know they were in there.
So that's going to be that one.
Yeah.
A bugbear with an 18-inch asshole? What? Why?
Because you're a huge asshole.
Oh, just because I'm a huge... Okay, so you're just saying that because there isn't a game where you just play as a huge asshole yet.
Yeah.
But if there was, it'd be me.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. That's all right. We've gotten our digs in.
There you go.
You're never going to make us that mad at each other, guys. we're buds for life.
Super buds.
Faux life, yo.
Super best friends.
Hang on, let's do our secret handshake that the listeners can't see. Yeah, look at us doing it. Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah.
Around the back. Whoop, whoop, whoop. Over the moon. Yep.
Ha!
This is the part with a milkshake.
Mmm, delicious milkshakes.
This is a good one. And we're done. We go now live to a question from the ghost of Dr. Murder, who asks, dear System Masters, is it possible for a game to discuss how men and women are different and might face unique struggles in a game world and represent this within the rules of the game? Or are all invariably doomed to fatal/fantasy wargaming/space 1889-style sexism? And are there games that you know of that deal with gender dynamics in interesting ways? Crapfully yours, Dr. Murder. Oh, nice. We got like a Homestar Runner sign off there.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because it's female. How do you type with boxing gloves on?
For me, the way you do, like, oh, let me tell you about the, like, difficulties or challenges that might be unique to a specific gender in a setting shouldn't be codified within, especially your stats to
start
with.
Yeah, I think that's the right place to start this answer here is it shouldn't be in stats. Because think about it. Imagine statting out a human on the GURPS scale, for example. So, like, from 1 to infinity, but realistically from, like, 1 to 6. Okay,
well,
now...
Well, the GURPS scale's 1 to 18.
Oh, well, fine. Screw you, GURPS.
Or 3 to 18,
let's
really,
go back to
whatever.
Let's go back to D&D, then. D&D uses 3 to 18, much simpler. And imagine that you're like, oh, I've got a strength of 10, but my girlfriend is very slightly weaker than me, so she probably has... No, she has a 10 as well. Strength in humans ranges from a much larger scale than 3 to 18. It's a massive abstraction.
Yeah.
And the idea that this massive abstraction has room in it for gender dynamics is silly. And not only that, but it's pointless to do because all it's doing is stopping people from making interesting characters.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you look at a system where you have things like stat requirements for specific things, mm-hmm. stuff like that. It just ends up being like, oh, okay, great. So you're less likely to be able to be whatever. It's the same thing like in the Fatal Review where we're like, oh, yeah, well, the smartest person ever was a woman, but invariably that can't happen in my system because I hate women.
Yeah. I mean, granted, that game was straight up sexist, but there are games that try to do this just because they're, you know, legitimately trying to go for some bio truths.
Yeah.
They aren't necessarily malicious. They're just wrong-headed.
Yeah.
Is there a way to do that in a right-headed fashion? I mean, there are definitely ways to tell unique stories about men or about women that where the character wouldn't be interchangeable. That said, it happens at the story level.
Yeah. It's going to be narratively, it's going to be in the universe, stuff like that. punishing someone for being a certain gender in a game, while, you know, that might be a thing like, oh yeah, in my game, if you play a woman, you get 70% of the treasure that a man gets. You're like, okay, I get what you're saying, but it also means you're in a game where you get to pick that, which ends up being like, okay, well, now I just don't want to be a woman. And instead of learning a lesson, you're just like, oh, women are terrible.
Yeah, that's all you're really picking up from that kind of rule interchange. The whole idea that it's for historical accuracy is largely irrelevant. No one wants to play a historically accurate world. That's not a real thing. No, whenever people play D&D, they're not actually playing 12th century peasant simulator. They're playing, we are rad superheroes that happen to fight in the medium of swords versus the medium of orcs.
Yes.
And in that kind of situation, what's the point of... think about your favorite TV shows. Have you ever thought about how Xena's warrior princess's strength is probably lower because she is a woman?
Yeah.
No, people don't have that thought because Xena's a rad princess with a rad weapon.
Yeah.
Sort of a rad weapon. Those chakrams are sort of cool.
Chakrams.
Mostly she just has a rad girlfriend and she gets to hang around with a cool dude named Joxer. So I don't feel like necessarily these things need to be represented in the game world. Now, can you tell a story that's from a uniquely feminine perspective and aimed at women in general and about the plight of being a woman? Absolutely. But there's no reason to start with handcuffs on.
Yeah.
So there you go. Are there games that do it well already? There are games that tell individual stories like that well already. Monster Hearts, for example, has some great stuff about the differences between the genders. There are other games out there that do that, but they don't do it by saying, but you're weaker, but don't worry, you get plus one constitution because you can have children.
Yeah.
None of that. It always rings false. There's no way for it not to.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
All right. And last question of the podcast, Scurvy Ninja. Dear Jeff and John, one of my favorite styles of game is one involving a military campaign. The game I feel pulls this off the best is Death Watch from Fantasy Flight. It combines the military feel with individual personalities in a well-planned manner, assuming players have a buy-in for playing Space Marines in the 40K universe. Many role players I have talked to hate the structured feel. Many dislike the idea of one of the players being in charge of the others. Most hate the idea of being railroaded by mission objectives. Games like Recon from Palladium left almost no room for personal growth for your character if you played straight from the book style. I would love to hear your opinions on military-style campaigns and RPGs and whether or not you have enjoyed them.
Well, have you ever played in a military-style campaign? I've played in one.
Not really. I mean, I've been in games where it's been like, you're in a mercenary company and someone's the head of the merc company. And I've had that be where someone else's character was in charge, and I've had one where my character was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And it never really mattered.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of games that are supposed to be about military discipline, that kind of goes out the window right away because you can't take your friend being like, I order you to take that sniper's nest very seriously.
Yeah.
Plus, you know more about your character than... Because that's one of the important things about a military commander type is he has to rigorously know everything about every person in his unit. What their strengths are, what their limits are, and so on. That's what defines a good field commander. And for one player at your table to be like, I know everything about every character here, and then for the characters to be like, I don't know my own character, please tell me if I have a high dexterity or not, it doesn't really flow. So I've never had good luck with the one guy's in charge scenario.
Now, I mean, when you look back on some RPGs, stuff like the shock collar,
mm-hmm.
you've got the old D&D thing where one guy was going to be sort of the one who told the DM what you would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of had that initial codifying of it.
Can I tell you, for about a minute now, I could have sworn you said shock collar.
You know,
and I've been trying to figure out what game had you wearing a shock collar. Now I'm realizing you said shot collar.
Yeah, the shot collar.
Okay, now I feel better.
You know, when you're playing the running man and you've got that shock collar.
Yeah, that's great. When you're playing old boy.
Yeah, so, I mean, there have been stuff in games where someone might have a position of authority, but it still isn't, I decide what everyone does. And I think that's the big thing that most people would be against, is someone telling them, how to play. In the same way that, like, when you're playing a co-op board game and you get that quarterbacking problem of, well, you need to do this, and I'll do that, and they'll do this.
Yeah. Yeah, that can always be a problem in board games. I feel like the reason I normally gravitate away from military-style campaigns is, and here's the thing, I don't actually do that. It's just that what you're describing, a game where you're railroaded by mission objectives, isn't going to be a very exciting game because theoretically everything's going to work the way it's supposed to. It'll be like, all right, you guys have to head out to this location and pick up this civilian and bring him back here for evac. And then indeed you do. The best games, and the military campaign I played in, was all about military discipline breaking down. It was like, you guys are assigned to go out into these woods and investigate this thing. And then once we got out into the woods, we lost contact with home base and started getting attacked from all sides by monsters and fairies and stuff. And it was all about, we had a commanding officer who was an NPC and he was killed immediately. So it was like, we are all military guys playing in the absence of military discipline.
Yeah.
And that was awesome because it was like, okay, the wheels have come off here. It's just like, the reason D&D is fun isn't because you go into a room and defeat the average number of orcs you can defeat. It's because you're taking risks and having interesting challenges and shit is happening that you did not expect.
Hmm.
That's what makes games fun. And it's the same with military stuff. If you're playing in a military campaign and shit goes crazy and everything's all weird, that's a good game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a Rifts game I played in, by the way. It was we played Coalition soldiers who went into haunted woods and were accosted by evil fairies and Dybbuks and stuff. It was called, we called the campaign Violin Company, and it was the coolest game. It was super fun. We had, and we also, we went out of our way to have, like, everything from Coalition represented. So we had, like, a grunt, and we didn't have a Samus pilot because he would have been able to void the whole concept.
Yeah.
But we had a grunt, we had a heavy armored dude, we had a dog boy, we had a Psystalker. And those guys were great because they started picking up evil intent coming out from the woods, and so they were more scared than everyone else. It was a really fun game. And, everyone had, like, oh, I'm a dog boy. I respond to commands. That's what I want. I want commands. Oh, no, my master's dead. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So there are games that can make it work. All right, so there you go. That is every question that anyone has ever asked us. But if we haven't answered your question, it's because we forgot about it, so send it to us again.
Yeah.
And that has been the Afterthought Podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening. You can find us at SystemMasteryPodcast.com. That's also where you can find our real podcast, System Mastery, where we review role-playing games, and our movie review podcast, which you would be amazed to learn, is called Movie Mastery. That's at SystemMasteryPodcast.com or System Mastery on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, or Reddit. One thing I should definitely mention is we have our new Kickstarter goal up. We are currently around $550 or so per episode. At $600 per episode, we will start doing live actual play content in Gamma World. That's going to be a new thing we're going to try. We've only done a couple of live play experiences before, but we get a lot of requests for them. So once again, if you're not a Patreon subscriber yet, get in there and help us push towards that goal.
Yep.
Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. John, you got anything else you want to say?
No, not really.
Well, good. Then you can be done and go home and be sick.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening, and have a wonderful week.